Hello, welcome everyone. Welcome on this fine afternoon to the World Affairs Council. My name is Lisa Falsco. I'm the CEO, and it's such a pleasure to have everyone here on this great day, and you're in for a treat for today's program. If you wouldn't mind turning off your cell phones, today's program is being recorded on KSKA. Thank you so much to Will Toyer for doing the recording today. If you'd like to listen to this program or any of our past programs, you can go to the KSKA website at alaskapublic.org and look under AWAC Presents to find a list of our previous programs. Then you can download those on your iPhone or any other device you might have to listen to them. We are a membership organization, and memberships expired in June, so if you currently are not a member, please consider joining the World Affairs Council and supporting our programs that we present here. We are nonpartisan, nonpolitical. We don't support the opinions of our speakers. We try to bring a variety of topics for our community, so please consider joining the World Affairs Council. If this is your first Alaska World Affairs Council, would you mind raising your hands? Do we have any new people? Great. Welcome. And our special guests from the San Francisco Consul are new today. Well, thank you very much for coming, and I hope you like it. And if you do, we will be here again next week. We'll actually be next door in the top of the world, it's called, over on this side, where we'll be featuring Ambassador Shireen Tahir Khali, who will be speaking on understanding Muslim societies. It's a special speaker who we won a grant through our national office to bring her here, so hope you can join. If you're a student, if you wouldn't mind standing and being recognized, do we have any students today? Wonderful. Super. Thank you all so much, very much for coming, and thank you so much to BP for sponsoring our students. BP sponsors our student lunches so that they can come every single week for free, and we'd like to thank them for that generous sponsorship. I'd like to now introduce our head table. To my far left is Mr. Greg Wolf, the Executive Director of the World Trade Center of Alaska and former board member of the World Affairs Council. And he is the partner in today's program, and it was such a pleasure to have you. Thank you. And to his right, I'd like to introduce Dr. Diddy Hitchens, who is a past president of the World Affairs Council, a longtime supporter, head of the Consular Corps, and she will be coming up to introduce our guest speaker today. Dr. Hitchens.
It is, as always, a great pleasure to be with the Alaska World Affairs Council. But it's a particular pleasure for me today. I did a calculation, and I think this is since I've been British Consul, which is since mid-1980s, I think this is my seventh Consul General who I've introduced to come and speak, and I think I've had four ambassadors, British ambassadors, who come to speak. But it is a particular pleasure today. I think it's true to say that all of the consuls general and all of the ambassadors who I have introduced in the past have been jolly good chaps. But it's wonderful to be introducing for the first time a representative of the British government who is also a woman. Priya Guha joined the Foreign and Commonwealth Office as a career diplomat right after university. She was born in Yorkshire in England and grew up in England. She did a degree in social and political sciences at Christ College, Cambridge. When she was an undergraduate, she clearly already knew what her destination was going to be, since she had an undergraduate attachment with the British Embassy in Beijing. Having joined the Foreign Service, she was with the Future of Europe team and indeed headed that section for a number of years. For 4 years, she was based in Madrid in Spain. Immediately prior to her appointment a year ago as Consul General in San Francisco, she had a four-year appointment with the British High Commission in India. in the British Foreign Service, when it's a Commonwealth country, it's called a High Commission, and when it's not a Commonwealth country, then it's an embassy. So in India, she was with the High Commission and was indeed our political affairs officer there, which is in many ways the most important position in the embassy, dealing with UK and Indian bilateral affairs. But I was absolutely delighted when I discovered just a year ago that she was coming to join us in San Francisco and to be British consul there, and in many ways to present a new face and new role for British diplomacy in the world, reflecting how we keep up with the times and how our diplomatic service is changing. So I am delighted to introduce Priya Guha, British Consul General in San Francisco.
Thank you so much, Didi, for those very kind words of introduction. It's wonderful to see some familiar faces in the room, and particularly great to have the students with us. And I just wanted to give one shout out for the fifth grade class from Wonder Park at the back, who I had the pleasure to have a chat with earlier. It's wonderful to see you all here in so many ways. All the younger generation in this room are the future of all types of diplomacy. And so I hope you'll ask me some particularly probing questions at the end. Thank you very much to the Alaska World Affairs Council for so graciously hosting this lunch. Last year you hosted Sir Nigel Sheinwald, who retired as British Ambassador to the United States in January this year. I am very pleased to be able to address you this time round, although of course Sir Nigel will be a very tough act to follow. I'm especially delighted to be here in the great state of Alaska on this, my first official visit to the state. Since we arrived here on Monday, my team and I have spoken to state and local politicians, business leaders, and university officials. We have discussed, amongst other topics, business, education, and the environment. In addition to Anchorage, we've also been up to Fairbanks. In future visits, I hope to be able to explore this beautiful state further, because it is truly an extraordinary part of the world. You know better than I that the first person to begin charting Alaska's shoreline systematically was a fellow Yorkshireman by the name of Captain James Cook, whose statue now stands in your Resolution Park here. In the course of his three epic journeys, Cook sailed thousands of miles and became the first European to visit Australia, the Sandwich Islands, Hawaii, as well as the first person to map the coasts of New Zealand and the Pacific Northwest. The sheer audacity of Cook's voyages reflects a character trait that Brits share with Alaskans, namely a thoroughly global outlook. Since its founding in 1958, just before Alaska itself became the 49th state of the Union, the Alaska World Affairs Council has been nurturing that international perspective by educating professionals and students in global affairs. And Alaska's international connections continue to grow. As Governor Parnell announced on April the 13th, Alaska's 2011 exports were its largest ever at $5.2 billion, an increase of over 25% since 2010. Foreign-owned businesses support some 12,800 jobs in this state, and 4,000 of those jobs, almost one-third of the total, depend on British companies. British business has been investing in Alaska since at least the 1840s, when the Hudson's Bay Company set up shop at what is now Fort Yukon. For over 25 years, the company traded with the local native populations. But this trade came to an abrupt end in 1869, 2 years after the Alaska Purchase, when the US Army came north to expel the company from the new state. Alaska's exports may have changed a little since then, to say nothing of its hospitality to foreign investors. Today, British companies are heavily invested in key Alaskan industries. As you know, one of them, a sponsor of the World Affairs Council's activities, is the energy giant BP, which owns reserves, pipelines, and infrastructure across the state. CCP has been here since 1959, the year Alaska became a state. Over the years, the company has invested over $20 billion in its oil production facilities on the North Slope and in the Alaskan economy. It has recently become renewing these facilities with an eye to future production. Of the 4,000 Alaskan jobs that depend on British investment, BP accounts for over 2,000, and most importantly, 82% of them are recruited locally here in Alaska. In turn, BP seeks to invest in the communities that provide it with so many high-quality employees. It was wonderful to hear about the sponsorship scheme for students to join these lunches today. Since 1985, the company has distributed some $2.8 million in the form of scholarships to 675 Alaskan high school graduates. This is just one example of the commitment British businesses show when investing abroad, not just to the local economy, but to the local community too. The relationship between the Alaskan and British energy sectors is, of course, a special one, given the abundance of Alaska's natural resources and the global prominence of the UK's energy companies. But the fact is, there are British business success stories in every part of the union. The depth and breadth of the economic relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom is truly astounding. We are each other's largest foreign investors, with almost $1 trillion in total invested between the two economies. For all the talk of an Asian century, the UK's investment in the US dwarfs that of China. In fact, it is 116 times greater. 1 million people in the United States wake up in the morning and go to work for a British company. Every day, 1 million people in the United Kingdom wake up in the morning and go to work for an American company, making our two countries by far each other's largest foreign job creators. What's more, these jobs are typically highly skilled and high paying. An American working for a British company in the United States can expect to earn about 45% more than the average salary. The relationship is similarly robust when it comes to trade. US-UK trade flows in 2011 were worth $208 billion, a 10% increase from the previous year, outstripping every other European Union member state, including Germany. These impressive statistics go some way to explain why the British government invests so much in its embassy and consular network within the United States. In addition to the embassy in Washington, D.C., we have a network of 9 consulates generals and 19 honorary consuls around the U.S., including, of course, your own Diddy Hitchens here in Anchorage. My own patch covers a sizable chunk of the Northwest, comprising Northern California, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, and last but very much not least, Alaska. The British government's network employs some 659 people, 235 of whom, almost a third, work outside Washington. Our staff are both diplomats posted from London and locally hired personnel who are truly experts in many areas of the United States issues around public affairs with which we deal. I myself, as Diddy mentioned, work for the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office, the equivalent of the State Department here in the US. But our relationship with the US goes far broader. This is why the British government has representatives in this country from every single one of its home departments, from defence to international development to agriculture to health to education. I would just like to take this opportunity to introduce a few of my colleagues who are with me here today. Jacqueline Mason, who is the head of our trade and investment team in San Francisco. Robin Newman, who is the West Coast Director for Politics, Press and Public Affairs. And Nicola Richardson, who is the head of our consular services operations. What exactly do we do with all these resources? Well, my boss, the Foreign Secretary William Hague, set out 3 priorities when he took office in 2010. Prosperity, security, and consular services. Unsurprisingly, all 3 of them are vitally important to our relationship with the United States. Prosperity covers all our efforts to assist British business in the United States and US investors seeking to access opportunities in British markets. Given the scale of the economic relationship between our two countries, this is obviously a major part of what we do. But prosperity also includes, for example, facilitating the incredibly fruitful educational and academic partnerships that exist between our two countries. We are each other's top destinations for study abroad. Almost 50,000 Americans study in the UK each year. Some of the best among them are selected as Marshall Scholars to come to the UK and attend our top institutions. The Marshalls were set up by the British government in honour of the great American general and peace builder, George C. Marshall. Each British consulate selects a number of students from its own region. I am part of the regional selection panel and can personally vouch for the quality of students that come through that programme. I would love to see more Alaskan students apply for Marshall Scholarships. This is a comment directed at a few of you in the room. Which is one of the reasons why, on this trip, I have been meeting with some of the senior leadership of Alaska's top universities. In research, the US-UK relationship is equally productive. Over 5,000 British university staff have research links to the US, and around 4,000 American research students are currently working in the UK. Some 26 Nobel Prizes have been shared between British and American researchers. My team and I have been exploring opportunities for UK-Alaskan cooperation on Arctic science research and more broadly on the commercialisation of ideas that come out of the brightest and best of our universities. Our second major priority is security. Here in the United States, that means fostering the extraordinary military relationship that has developed over the past 200 years. British troops have stood shoulder to shoulder with their US counterparts in six major joint campaigns in the past two decades alone. Our countries enjoy unparalleled cooperation on nuclear weapons, technology and counterterrorism, amongst other security-related issues. The third and final major priority is consular services, which is to say helping British nationals abroad. Here too, the UK has vital interests in this country. About 680,000 British nationals live in the United States, and 4 million visit each year. You may not be aware, but about 20% of the tourists that come into Alaska are Brits. Inevitably, some of them get into difficulties. We are there to help when they do. In this capacity, we deal with situations ranging from natural disasters to cross-border child custody disputes. The nature of our engagement with the United States has changed dramatically since the days when pinstripe bureaucrats cut deals over brandy and cigars. I wanted to highlight some areas where I believe the face of British diplomacy is indeed changing. In the shape of the courageous men and women who serve in our armed forces. The Paralympics, which first started in London back in 1948, are a great occasion to celebrate their commitment. And it would be remiss of me not to congratulate your own local Paralympian, Shelley Riley, who won silver in the 5,000 metres wheelchair race. In 2012, the UK became the first country to send an international contingent to the Warrior Games, an annual sports competition designed to introduce wounded US veterans to Paralympic sport. This was a great honour for us, and one that reflected the closeness of our military partnership on a personal level. A number of the British and American athletes taking part in the London Paralympics are indeed veterans who fought together in Iraq and Afghanistan. On the day of the opening ceremony, the ambassador published an op-ed in the Huffington Post saluting our veterans and highlighting the UK-US military relationship. Throughout both the Warrior Games and the Paralympics, we have tracked the progress of British veteran athletes and told their remarkable stories through our social media channels. Our network here in the United States has fully embraced social media platforms. We have popular and regularly updated pages on Facebook, Pinterest, Tumblr, YouTube, and a number of very lively Twitter feeds. This brings me to the second change. which is that we are making increasing use of our technology in diplomacy. Through our online presence, we showcase British culture and sport, including most recently the Edinburgh Festival and London 2012. We also publicise our other public diplomacy efforts, such as the Ambassador's regular column in the Huffington Post. Our content is deliberately rich in attention-grabbing headlines and images and hyperlinks, which is where the web really adds value. We have been very successful in generating interest through social media. For example, our UK in USA Twitter handle has over 16,000 followers, and our Facebook page has more than 4,700 likes. We are also using technology on our consular work. Passport and visa services have been brought online and centralised, helping to keep costs low. We provide passports and consular services to British citizens at a cost of only $2.38 per passport per year. And technology can also help in a crisis. Last year, British consular staff in Japan used Facebook to track down missing people after the tsunami. We use social media to provide travel advice and emergency advice, most recently around Tropical Storm Isaac. Thirdly, our personnel increasingly reflect the diversity of the society we're here to represent. The proportion of staff from minority ethnic communities in the Foreign Office's workforce is now around the same level as in British society as a whole. We still have work to do on attracting and retaining disabled and female employees, but I'm pleased to say that the US network is leading the way. 59% of our locally engaged personnel in the US are women. And on a personal note, I am very proud to contribute towards this trend in two ways, as someone of mixed British and Indian heritage, and also, as Didi said, the first female Consul General in San Francisco. Finally, our diplomacy is increasingly proactive rather than simply reactive. This involves engaging in what the Foreign Secretary has called a more expeditionary approach to identifying threats and taking steps to deal with them before they become threats. Last year, the Foreign Office organised a two-day global conference on cybersecurity, bringing together leading figures from politics, international security, and the tech industry. Speakers included Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia. The conference has helped shape our thinking around how cybersecurity threats might affect our work in the years ahead, and indeed in the decades ahead. Proactive diplomacy also has a role to play on the prosperity side of our agenda, which is why the Foreign Office has created a new team to provide staff with enhanced training in commercial diplomacy, giving them the skills and knowledge necessary to identify openings for British business in foreign markets, to argue for host governments to reduce barriers to trade, and to support trade with and inward investment to the UK. At the same time, more private sector secondments are being made available to senior Foreign Office staff to give them a better understanding of the way business operates. I hope this has given you a good overview of how British diplomacy in the United States and around the world is adapting to the pressures and opportunities of the 21st century. We are working in towns, cities, districts, states, and across the United States, reaching out not just to government, but to businesses, universities, communities, cultural institutions, and the general public, harnessing technology to deliver our messages and serve our stakeholders, working together with the United States for mutual prosperity and security in our own and each other's interests. The close partnership between the United States and the United Kingdom is unprecedented in history, and there is no better place to highlight that relationship than the great state of Alaska. Thank you very much, and I look forward to your questions.
I want to thank the Consul General for those great words, and she has graciously agreed to answer some questions. If you wouldn't mind waiting for the microphone, this is being recorded, and I'll bring the microphone back to Consul General Priya Guha.
Right, who's going first? Paul.
So, just wanted to thank you very much for a wonderful presentation on what you're currently up to in the United States, but my question is actually based upon your past job experience. I'll actually resist the temptation to ask you how any predictions you might have made about the future of Europe have panned out, and instead talk about, I believe, your last posting before this one in India. And would just like to get your basic impressions on sort of past trends, present developments, and what you think might be the future in that region.
That's a great question, and I think so much of attention in recent decades has been about the rise of Asia and what that means. And whilst I know the most immediate embodiment of that here in the Pacific facing parts of the US is China, actually India and the South Asian part of the world is an incredibly dynamic part of that bigger story. I have a certain bias towards India, as you probably imagine. So I was, on a personal level, absolutely thrilled to be given the opportunity to serve there as a representative of the UK government. It is a fascinating country. I don't know if any of you have had the chance to visit. It is massive on a scale that is even hard to imagine in a country as large as the United States. It has a population that will surpass that of China's within just a few decades. And it also is in a region which is of incredible strategic importance because of its position bordering Afghanistan, Pakistan. What is also very incredible to watch in action is the world's largest democracy. There is nothing as heartwarming as seeing rural villagers walk for miles and miles to be able to exercise their right to vote. It is wonderful to see democracy in action. In terms of opportunity, in India, you also see the rise of some incredible dynamic industry. You have, probably you're aware of the area around parts like Bangalore, which is very, very cutting edge technological development around Indian owned industries like Infosys and others, where the brightest and best are actually being trained in these very exciting parts of the tech sector. But there are also many other dynamics going on in a country as diverse and large as India. We talk about climate change in the context of things happening in the Arctic here. But in India, you have many challenges around climate issues. You have flooding in low areas of the country. You have drought in other areas of the country. And indeed, water will no doubt be an area where it will be controversial and difficult to be able to allocate water resources in the future. I talked about the geopolitical importance of India, and I know that is a core aspect to our relationship, as indeed the United States' relationship with India, and we both see India as a key ally in future stability and peace in that region. So I think whilst every country has its own challenges, and India is by no means immune from the global recession, it is a land of many, many opportunities in the future. And I know that both the UK and the US see that as a place where they will want to be a key ally, both now and in the years ahead.
Jim Muller in political science at UAA. Thank you so much for coming. And I wondered if you could say a little bit more about the consular cooperation among diplomats from various countries in San Francisco. We have a very close consular corps, of course, here in Anchorage. But I wonder whether, on the strength of that, you can say a little bit about differences between the way various other nations whose diplomats you know are conducting their diplomacy and the picture of British diplomacy you've given us. Thanks.
Thank you, Jim. That's a great question. And you rightly note that actually there is a very strong consular cooperation here, led most recently by the new dean of the local consular corps, Didi. But we have a very large representation of foreign governments in San Francisco, which is where I'm based. I believe we have about 125 consuls, amongst which there are about 70 career diplomats running those offices. So what does that mean in terms of the different interests of all those different countries? I think the reality is that every country has a particular focus for their activity. I've talked about the breadth and depth of the UK's interests in the US, but we have a particularly strong and special relationship with the United States. Other countries have particular priorities. Just to give an example, I've always been astounded by the number of nationals that, for example, my Mexican colleagues are dealing with, and that takes up a big proportion of their time just because of the needs that they have in terms of servicing those communities. Equally, a big focus for my Chinese colleague is inevitably the trade and investment relationship, particularly the trade relationship. And so that every country has a particular priority, and that just generally affects their own domestic interests. But what you do see is a consistent ambition to do more with the United States, which I think is really welcome for all of us.
Thank you. My name's Heather Hudson. I'm also from UAA, directing the Institute of Social and Economic Research. And I wondered, you'd mentioned in the introduction about British industry, including the oil industry here, but also international trade and security, and what the British government's thoughts are on the growing opening of the Arctic water, or potentially the Northwest Passage, as well as northeastern sea routes and other issues that are changing perhaps international trade in the high north, as well as other issues, including the environment. Thank you.
It's so interesting because one of the common themes to all the discussions I've had this week is indeed that issue and what are the impacts in all senses of the world from the changing face of Arctic ice in particular. I think firstly, that is a real area for collaboration between the UK and US's scientific community. That is something that I mentioned in my remarks earlier, but we believe we do have a very strong expertise in terms of Arctic science, and we look forward to working even more closely with colleagues here in Alaska in terms of sharing that knowledge and working together to identify the best future. It has been very interesting to understand the discussions that are happening here in Alaska around the opportunities that the Northwest Passage will create for trade and investment links. And it was very clear that most people who we spoke to saw this as an opportunity. And I'm sure that British businesses who would want to take advantage of that trade route would share that sentiment. As always, these discussions need to be taken place in a sustainable environment. And what I would want to leave you with is just the reassurance that the British government would stand very firmly with the Alaskan authorities in terms of determining a future there, which both allowed us to utilise these routes for commercial purposes, but also do that in a sustainable way.
Back to India. Can you give us some insight into the nature of the Indian investments in England, and specifically with the status of the Tata investments in Jaguar, Rover, and I don't know how many other companies?
You point out something that is a very welcome opportunity that has taken place in the past few decades for the UK. We've had significant Indian investment in the UK. You mentioned Tata and Jaguar Land Rover, and indeed, those investments have proved very successful to companies, and we've seen reinvestment in some of the plants and facilities and expansion of those facilities in recent years, despite the global economic conditions. But it goes more broadly than that. There's also big investment in, for example, Mittal Steel, the steel company, and a number of other firms across all levels of larger-sized companies and smaller-sized companies. So it's been significant, and it's something that the UK government has really welcomed as it's built up, particularly using the Tata example, our manufacturing sector to some great strengths. So we're very proud of that.
Council General, I believe we've met. My question is, your country has an immigration problem. Well, I could be incorrect, but that's what I read. Would you please address that and tell me what steps are being taken to improve or get rid of the problem?
Thanks, Rod. I can always rely on you for a good question. I wouldn't characterize it as a problem. When the current government came into power in May 2010, what they were very clear about was what they had to deal with was what was a historical challenge, which was people coming into the UK using one type of visa to actually undertake a different form of activity. And the UK, like the US, has a requirement to get a hold of that and try and make sure that the visa regime stops what is indeed basic fraud and abuse of a system. So when the coalition government came in, they introduced a different visa system. And that visa system was intended to do two things. Firstly, stop the flow of people who were using one type of visa to undertake a different type of activity, most commonly to work on a visa when they'd come in as a student, for example. But the other strand of what the government did and part of its policies was to make sure that the visa regime that they put in place did not stop what we wanted to encourage, which was legitimate business activity and legitimate tourism activity and legitimate family visits activity between the UK and all its global allies. So indeed, the government has put in new visas to facilitate that form of people coming into the UK, things like an entrepreneur's visa, where if someone wants to set up a new business in the UK and they can prove they've got an idea and some money behind that, then we will bring them with open arms into the UK and allow them to take forward that idea. So I think we've, no road is simple, but we have made significant progress in terms of getting a system in place that both tackles that problem of fraud, but doesn't stop legitimate people wanting to come to the UK.
I'm Elaine.
What's your question about?
Do you know if there are any British companies mining in Alaska?
Do I know if there are any British companies
mining in Alaska?
Well, there's one British company which is currently exploring that possibility, and I know that a number of British companies are working with other countries and their companies to which are currently in exploration.
If I could, a bit more of a personal question. You mentioned that the Foreign Service now reflects more or less the kind of multicultural face of Great Britain. Changing the face of Great Britain clearly is not going to be accomplished without some difficulty, and I presume changing the face of the Foreign Office also involves that. And so I wonder how that might be reflected in your own personal experience coming up through the service.
That's another great question. I think the reality is that every organisation has a culture associated with it. And what happens as a result of that culture is that it attracts a certain type of individual, and perhaps in the UK context, someone from a certain background. But cultures change. And what's been great in the context of the British Foreign Office is we've seen some significant cultural changes, even just in the 15 years since I've been part of that organisation. Hierarchies have dropped. There's less people with double-barreled names. And it's been an environment that has actually encouraged many more people to think about that as an opportunity, and also allowed more people to come up through the ranks and break through what might have been historical barriers. So it's been a very interesting process, but some pretty significant cultural change, I would say, over the time I've been in part of the service.
Hi. Hi, my name is Ilona Farr, and my daughter Rebecca is actually going to be studying at University of Edinburgh Vet Med Program.
Brilliant.
But everything is very expensive, and the question is, how do we go about getting information about these scholarships?
Well, I have a colleague who's sitting just in front of me, Robin, who is the owner, in inverted commas, of our scholarships programs here on the West Coast, so he can give you the detailed information. But what I just should say for both yourself, your daughter, and the broader audience is that I mentioned the Marshall Scholarships Program, which is one that the British government runs ourselves. But there are also a number of other great scholarships programs that are worth looking at. Rhodes, Gates, Churchill, Commonwealth, English Speaking Union. There's a whole range of scholarships available. And the last thing we would want is that someone who was dynamic, enthusiastic, and keen to take advantage of an opportunity to study in the UK was blocked because of financial constraints. So we'd love to have a word separately about how we might point you in the direction of those.
My question might be based on a mishearing of you. Did you refer to 200 years of military cooperation?
The 200 years was in a slightly different context.
I'm just noticing behind you it says 2012 on the board, and I was thinking, oh, 1812.
We marked some pretty significant anniversaries recently, but I think the strength of that, the strength of our relationship is demonstrated by the fact that the British ambassador turned up to most of those. So.
Since I'm on the subject of history, I should correct any impression you have that Captain Cook was one of the first people to find Alaska. It's well known that an eye doctor was the first person here, but it's been argued that it was an optical illusion. Let me get off of that and ask you, the hottest point in international affairs today is the possibility that Prime Minister Netanyahu may embark on acts of war against Iran, and I wonder whether your boss has given you any instruction with respect to how you respond to that, or whether you know anything about the British government's position on that.
All I can say is that on issues like that, the British government follows them 24/7. They are obviously issues of great global significance and impact, and we, having had a long history in the region, in Iran and in the region there, we feel that we have both an interest in terms of a national interest, but also an expertise in that region. We don't work on that independently. It won't come as a surprise to any of you in the room to know that the Foreign Secretary and his counterparts here in the US, and indeed other parts of our government, talk on a regular basis about these issues in some depth. And indeed, our ambassador is regularly in state in the White House talking about these issues of great foreign policy concern. So we watch it closely. We share concerns, but they are issues where I think the UK and the US working together to share knowledge and expertise will reach the right conclusions.
Hello. My question is also touching upon study abroad. I know in her experience that for her children, you know, generally study abroad was more expensive in the UK, but as I've seen, not compared to Alaska because our tuition is actually very cheap, but the average, you know, cost of studying abroad in UK, even with international fees, is so much less than the average US college tuition. I'm wondering, what is the economic benefits for the UK of allowing foreign students to pay, really only from the US, but allowing them to pay a lower tuition to come over to your country?
There's obviously a direct economic impact of having anyone in your own country, and you know, the fact is when people are somewhere, they do things, they spend money, they go travelling, and all that contributes to the local economy and the national economy. But I would say, you know, why is that in our interests? And the answer is much broader than that. You know, the economics aside, actually what that creates for us is a future generation of people who know the UK. We've had such a strong history between our two countries. It's great to perpetuate that with people who've had the chance to go and study and take advantage of academic excellence, but also go down to the pub, understand what Scotland is all about, get a sense of the great British bands that are out there. That creates a different sort of bond beyond the economics and something that's actually much more longer lasting.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank the Consul General again for coming, and as a token of the board's appreciation, they would like to present you with this little memory of Alaska.
Thank you so much. That's really kind.
You're so welcome. We hope to see her again soon. And I hope to see everyone next week. Again, we will be next door, where we will have Ambassador Shireen Tahir Kali, who is Newsweek's one of the 150 women most likely to change the world. So don't miss this program on Understanding Muslim Societies with Ambassador Kali. Oh, and we found some keys. Let me check to see if I want this car first. It's a Subaru, so if anybody is missing their Subaru keys, please come and see Kari. She has your keys. Thank you. Yeah,